It's time to play like a Jet
with your host, Scott Mason.
Play like a Jet. What does that mean?
Drops the throw, steps up, floats a bomb up the right seam, looking for Anderson. He's got it. They're not going to catch him. He's going to go the distance. Touchdown. Sam Darnold dials it up to Robbie Anderson. 92 yards.
Anderson, too much deflected.
Bell into the middle of that line, and it's a touchdown.
Big return for Crowder, 85 yards.
Pass thrown, there was contact with the quarterback, and it's incomplete. They got pressure on Prescott. It was Adams who came blitzing in.
Hill hit immediately when he got the handoff.
You know that's
the Q-inator.
Oh my gosh.
Listen, thank you.
From the TOJ Digital Studios, this is Play Like a Jet. My name is Scott Mason, and it is Wednesday, which means it's time for Midweek with Manish. Manish Mehta of the New York Daily News. Manish, it's been a strange couple of days, but then again, we've said that a lot this season, haven't we?
Yeah, I feel like we say that every week, that it's been an odd week. Every week seems to get stranger. Obviously, I don't know if it can get much worse than losing to the Dolphins, but the fallout, at least immediately, hasn't been good. Starting at the very top with the acting owner.
What is the mindset of Christopher Johnson at this point? Because Rich Simini from ESPN New York said that he saw Christopher Johnson hanging out after the game, and he did not look happy about anything. You also have the fact that Christopher Johnson had to have heard all the Fire Gase chants. I'm sure that people are bringing him headlines, so he knows what the fans are thinking right now. What's his mindset? What's going on with Christopher Johnson right now? What is he thinking? You think there's any chance that he's laser focused on the fact that they're going to have to make some sort of move at the end of the season?
Well, look, what's interesting is about him after the game is that I was with a bunch of reporters, and you could look into the Jet locker room, through the doors, and he was standing there by himself. My interpretation was not that he was fuming or anything like that. And look, everyone can look at a person standing there by themselves and conclude whatever they want, based on just kind of what their feel is and body language. My feeling was he was just standing there kind of waiting for the players to come. And I believe that he does that most, if not all, games. As the players go into the locker room, he'll give guys a pat on the back or a quick handshake, something like that. He wasn't stomping his feet. He wasn't ranting and raving and talking to himself and acting like a madman. That's not the case at all. Again, you can interpret it however you want to interpret it, but I witnessed all of that. And I just saw a guy who was standing there kind of contemplating perhaps what had happened. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. Again, that's just my personal interpretation. I was about 20, 30 feet away from him, like everybody else. And what I can tell you is that he is miffed at the criticisms at his decision to hire Adam Gase. He does not believe it's warranted. He believes that the sharp criticism from media, the criticism from the fan base, is unfair. I don't know if that's because he truly still believes in Adam Gase, or if this is really the front that he has to put up at this point, because pulling the plug on a guy that you went all in on in January and then doubled down on in May by firing the general manager and essentially allowing this head coach to pick his general manager, would be a bad look for Christopher Johnson. It would be a terrible look. I have criticized him myriad times for being indecisive, dating back to last year. And he's inexperienced, and I think that his decisions have been haphazard and really poorly thought out. I don't think he's getting very good direction, to be honest with you, in terms of other people in the organization, from a decision-making standpoint. The public relations has been an abject disaster, dating back to how things were handled after McCagnon was fired, most recently with the Coleccio Semele mess, and the notion that Christopher Johnson has not yet said a word publicly outside of, getting caught before the Jacksonville Jaguars game, essentially throwing Adam Gase and everybody under the bus for being non-competitive. But in a formal setting, he has not been held accountable whatsoever for Adam Gase's failings. And to me, that's a that's a failure of leadership. You know, I've been critical of Adam Gase's inability to lead. I think it extends beyond Gase. It extends to the man at the top at the moment, and that's Christopher Johnson. You know, real leaders kind of shine in these moments. When there's adversity, a true leader will step to the forefront, address, in this particular case, his fan base, and I don't know if they can, you know, if he can calm their agitation, but he certainly needs to explain his vantage point. Why are things going poorly? How does he feel about Adam Gase now? Does he have second thoughts? Is he fully supporting Adam Gase? None of that has happened. And it's not as if this would be a departure from, you know, what he had done in his first two seasons in charge. If he had not spoken at all in season since taking over for his brother temporarily 2 years ago, then, you know, the Jets could say, well, we're being consistent with our message. However, Christopher Johnson has spoken within the first 2 weeks of each of the past two seasons that kind of outline his vision, his hope for the team. He has not done that to this point. We're obviously at the midpoint of the season from a game standpoint. And I reached out to the Jets as recently as Monday and really just asked a simple question. Is Christopher Johnson going to be made available to discuss the current state of affairs? The Jets declined comment to me about whether he would even be available to talk. So again, I think that's poor public relations. That's just another problem in the infrastructure of this organization. There are, you know, there are reasons why bad organizations are bad. It flows from the top down. Strong leaders at the very top typically mean that you have a strong, successful organization. If you have weak, indecisive leadership at the top, you probably see that throughout the organization. And I think it's fair to say that the Jets are, you know, an organization that does not have strong leadership at various levels.
Play like a Jet. Play like a Jet.
If Christopher Johnson thinks that the criticism of his decision to hire Adam Gase is unfair, I'm not really sure why, because it was his decision. He decided who to listen to. He decided to make the hiring. And people will criticize reporters like yourself, Manish, because you were very bullish on the hiring at the beginning. You've since done a 180, and now you've been going after Gase for what you just outlined as his perceived failures. But the difference is, A, you changed when the facts on the ground changed. Now, I thought the facts on the ground were pretty clear from the beginning. I was dead set against this hiring for a million reasons that I outlined when it happened, both on the podcast and on social media. But at least you changed course when you saw how bad this has been. And on top of that, it's not like you have any culpability because you're just a reporter. You're not the one making this decision. So he has nobody to blame but himself. I'm not really sure what it is that he thinks is unfair here. And at this point, Manish, as far as I can tell, it's one of two things. Either he has deluded himself into believing that Gase is still the guy for this job, or he just stubbornly doesn't want to admit he's wrong, if it's indeed the case that he thinks that this is all unfair, because I really don't know what else it could be.
I think you characterized the situation perfectly. I don't definitively know whether he actually believes that Adam Gase is going to be a head coach, or as you said a moment ago, he's so invested in this coach to be successful that he needs to ride it out before jumping ship. And there's a financial element, and we've talked about this before, Scott, as well. The Jets are paying Mike Maccagnan and Todd Bowles through 2020, and I don't know if Woody Johnson would sign off on basically playing three head coaches, two fired ones, Gase, if he were to be fired, and Bowles, plus a fired general manager, in addition to the new head coach. I think, you know, it's not my money. Let me preface it by saying that. But the reality is that this is a multi-billion dollar company. So the notion of paying, guys who are still fired, you know, a few million dollars is not that big of a deal to me if indeed you want to win. If your goal is to improve the franchise and truly move in the right direction. I'm not saying that Adam Gase should be fired mid-season. I'm not saying that Adam Gase should be fired after the season. There's still eight games left. I know that fans are really upset at Gase, as they rightfully should be, because the product has been horrible. And not only has the product been horrible, but as we've discussed for the better part of 2 months, they've been non-competitive too many times. I mean, for God's sakes, Christopher Johnson admitted that to a fan. So obviously he sees that element to it. I just don't believe that he fully understands how poorly things are going inside that building, which is odd to say because he is at the top of the food chain right now. You would think that he would know not everything, because not everybody can know everything inside your own company. But, you know, as you alluded to a few minutes ago, I liked the hire. And as I've said before, I like Todd Monken as a better mentor for Sam Darnold. I loved Matt Rhule's CEO leadership skills, but I did like the Adam Gase hire because I thought he had really good ideas. And I still think he has really good ideas. However, I don't, as you said, I'm not paying the guy. I'm not making the decision, so I'm not culpable for the decision. So what I hear and get information over the course of 10 months now, it's not as if Adam Gase was hired a month ago or 3 weeks ago. It's been 10 months plus. So when I get information that I find particularly troubling about the dynamics of what's happening behind the scenes, his leadership or lack thereof, what he may or what he has said about current players to people behind the scenes, it's disturbing. I'm not a fan of the team, but I'm thinking, like, this man is supposed to be the leader of your franchise, and some of the things that he has said and done through back channels has been astounding to me. And I'm not at liberty to report a lot of that. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have not even gotten that information. But the fact that I have the information, I know the information, I am so fully confident that he absolutely needs to change his ways or the Jets are doomed with him in charge. They will not succeed if he continues operating the way he's operating. And I'm not even talking about the losses and the double-digit losses and the horrible product that you see on the field on Sundays. I'm talking about all the things that happen from the minute that he wakes up until the minute that he goes to bed on days that are not game days. He has not comported himself like a leader. I just cannot believe that a person who's the head coach of the New York Jets has done some of the stuff that he has done through back channels. It's unbelievable to me. And I wish, I dearly wish that I could share all that information. But I know that information. I have that information. And that's why I've been so critical of him, because I know that, again, unless he changes his ways, the Jets will fail. And unfortunately, Sam Darnold will fail.
And I suppose that's why you asked that question at the presser after the game.
Yeah, look, it's ironic or unfortunate, I guess, depending on your perspective. Adam Gase wanted to stick this to the Dolphins organization and specifically to Stephen Ross so badly. He wanted to win. He had designs in his mind of running up stuff, sticking it into that organization. I don't think you were going to see a situation if the Jets were up big entering the fourth quarter, Adam Gase was just going to run out the clock, for the last two or three drives. He was going to put and keep his foot on the pedal and try to run it up. That was his intention. That was his hope. That was his dream. That didn't happen. And so it was humiliating for him to lose to Stephen Ross. And it's funny because, the Dolphins are trying to position themselves, not the players and the coaches, but I think the fans would like, for their team to be positioned at the top of the 2020 draft so they can have their choice of quarterback, whether it's Tua, whoever it is, whoever they deem to be the guy to be the quarterback moving forward. So this does hurt them, in terms of draft positioning, but I'm pretty sure that if they were going to win a game, if they weren't going to go in 16, if they had to win a game at some point, that Stephen Ross was exceedingly pleased that he beat Adam Gase, because they had their differences, which have been well chronicled. And so the irony is that Adam Gase wanted to stick it to Stephen Ross, and unfortunately he got embarrassed. And this is a big boy industry. You have to ask tough questions. As I said before, Adam Gase has done some interesting things behind the scenes. So I don't think that any fan should feel any kind of pity for him or feel sorry for him after he gets embarrassed in this type of fashion. And from a Miami perspective, they knew this guy wasn't the right guy. And, just having him lose to them when they had not won a game yet, I think makes it that much sweeter for them and validates their decision to move on from Adam Gase.
In case anybody missed it, the question that Manish asked at the presser to Adam Gase, which caused Gase to say, I'm not going to answer that bleep and walk off, was whether or not this performance against the Dolphins vindicated Stephen Ross's decision to fire Gase as head coach of the Dolphins at the end of last season. There are some that would say that there were better ways you could have asked it and softer ways you could have asked it, Manish, but I think that most Jets fans certainly appreciated that somebody was willing to go there with Adam Gase. With Gase, though, Manish, we talked about the stubbornness of Christopher Johnson. We talked about the fact that Adam Gase is still trying to sell himself as a long-term answer as head coach. If this continues to snowball, if we continue to see regression from Sam Darnold, if we see the Jets perhaps embarrassed at home against the Giants, perhaps at home against the Miami Dolphins for a second time this season, will the noise get loud enough that you think Christopher Johnson will finally hear it?
You know, that's a great question. That's a question that, as of right now, I don't know the answer to. I don't know if the pressure will become so bad, if the environment will become so toxic that he'll feel the need to, you know, call Woody and say, look, we got to make a change. It obviously got very toxic with John Idzik, and you know, Jets fans were right. Just look at that 12-man draft that he had. The best player out of that draft was it Quincy? I'm trying to even.
Yeah, it was Quincy Enunwa.
Right. So I think time has proven that the Jets fans were right about John Idzik, and you know, I know that Jets fans sometimes get this perception that they're too reactionary and they don't know what they're talking about. They want to make changes every year, every other year. And my answer to that question is, well, what have they been wrong about to this point? Have they been wrong about anything? I don't think so, because the reason that Jet fans get up in arms is because the decisions made by the decision makers in the organization have been bad. If they're making good decisions, I don't think Jet fans would be complaining. You know, I think that Jet fans, by and large, believe that Sam Darnold can be a very good player, great player, special player, however you want to characterize it. So, I know it's not unanimous because you're never going to get that, but I think that Jet fans still believe in Sam Darnold even though he's struggling. So, I think that's a decision that Jet fans were on board with that the organization made. But when they sense through evidence, clear evidence, that a coach, a player, was a wrong decision, a wrong hire, they're going to let ownership know about it. And I would say, by and large, they're right most of the time. And that, to me, is not an indictment on the fan base. That's an indictment on ownership. That's an indictment on the decision makers in that organization. Just because you make bad decisions doesn't mean that you can pin the blame on fans or pin the blame on reporters who are chronicling these bad decisions. You have to take ownership of your terrible decisions. So the blame, to me, goes on the decision makers, whether it was a general manager, ultimately the owner has to sign off on everything. That's my position on any organization, not just the NFL, not just professional sports. It could be business. It could be technology. The best organizations have such strong leadership at the top, and there's no coincidence why they're successful. And then when you look at all these companies across the country who are failing, you have to ask, well, who's in charge? Who's running the show? And then you look closer at those people and dissect their decisions, and you realize, well, now this makes sense. You know, Adam Gase is making excuses left and right. His boss is hiding. He's not even accountable. So that's a failure of leadership at the head coaching spot and at the ownership spot. So that to me would be maddening if I were a Jet fan. What really would bother me, obviously, the most is losing every week, of course, right? It's a bottom line business. But beyond that, the fact there's been no accountability at the top, and even from Adam Gase, there's no real accountability. Just listen to what he's saying. He'll begrudgingly, take some of the blame if you ask him enough times. But more times than not, it's an excuse. It's one excuse after another. And even on Monday, when Gase was asked about his relationship with Christopher Johnson, he said, and I'm going to quote him here because it's such an eye-opening quote to me, he said, we've let him know kind of where we're at with our roster and our situations that we've had as far as who's moving in and out of the lineup. The translation to that sentence is, I've used injuries as an excuse, and I think that Christopher Johnson bought it. He's telling us right there that he is talking to Christopher Johnson and explaining and laying out his case for why the team has been so bad. And he's telling you, well, we have issues with guys going in and out of the lineup. What does that mean? That means he's talking about injuries. He's using injuries as an excuse. So right there, he's telling the fan base, yeah, I'm using these excuses, and my boss is buying it. And that's a problem. That should tick off fans. It really should. If I were a Jet fan and I heard that, I know people have busy lives. Maybe they didn't even pick up on this. But I heard him say this on Monday, and I was astounded. He is basically admitting to everyone that he's talking to the owner, and he's using injuries as an excuse as to why they're not performing as well as he had hoped. It's embarrassing.
In fairness to Gase, there's not really any other excuses that he could use other than the injuries, so I guess he's using what he's got at his disposal. I want to circle back to John Idzik for a second, because I think that the big problem with John Idzik was the execution. I think his plan was sound. He wanted to tear it all down and start from scratch. Unfortunately, his execution was poor. As you said, that draft specifically was really bad. They got one good player out of 12, that of course being Quincy Enunwa. I will say, though, that I did think that he did a pretty good job in negotiating a deal for Darrell Revis. Remember, the Jets got a first and a fourth, and it was a middle of the first round pick, too, so it wasn't a really, really low pick or anything like that. For a player who was about to get paid the richest contract that a cornerback ever got, and on top of it was coming off a season-ending injury, he was a couple years older than Jalen Ramsey at the time, too, so for people that are trying to equate those two deals, and of course, Ramsey was dealt in the middle of the season, so the price always goes up in those situations. But I'm curious if we're headed down this path in this offseason with Jamal Adams the same way that the Jets were when Idzik was going to be the one making the deal back in 2013, because it looks like there is a rift there that may not be able to be repaired. As far as I'm aware, Jamal Adams still hasn't spoken to Adam Gase or Joe Douglas, hasn't even referred to Joe Douglas by name. He just calls him the general manager. There's a lot of conjecture on both sides as to what's actually happening here. Adams played one of his worst games as a pro against Miami Dolphins on Sunday. I don't know if his heart's in it anymore. What do you think's going on here, Manish? Are we headed for a divorce at the end of the season? Can this be repaired?
I want to get to that, but I do want to circle back real quick to the Darrell Revis trade, just because it's Darrell Revis, and you know he's one of the best players in the history of the franchise. I think the return was fine that John Idzik got. I think the way that he handled Darrell Revis was not fine. I don't think you handle players of his stature the way that he was handled, basically forcing Revis to leave where he was training in Arizona to come back to New Jersey. It's just kind of a Bush League move. I thought it back then. I still do. Darrell Revis did make two Pro Bowls after he was traded. I don't necessarily believe he deserved to make the Pro Bowl with Tampa, because I don't think he particularly played well, because he was playing in his own scheme with Greg Schiano, but he got that Pro Bowl probably on reputation. He was an exceptional player for the New England Patriots. He was an important piece to their Super Bowl winning team. So it's not as if Darrell Revis, just dropped off the face of the earth. Now, when he returned to the Jets, he was garbage. That's obvious. But he did play well after he was traded by John Idzik, and he did help the team's arch rival win a Super Bowl by playing at a really high level. So that's just my take on the Revis thing. I think everybody knows how I feel about Revis when he returned. He mailed it in and took a lot of money. But I don't want it to make it seem like John Idzik traded away damaged goods who didn't do anything after he left, because he became a Super Bowl champion after he left the Jets.
Manish, if I could jump in real quick on that one, I will say that the Bucs did cut him 1 year later. And on top of that, I would also argue that Revis was nowhere near as good in New England as some people seem to remember. If you recall, at that point, he was no longer Revis Island. They were putting him up against the team's number two receiver and bracketing the number one receiver with two guys. And he got exposed quite a bit at the end of the playoffs there. He had some rough sledding. So he was still useful, but he was not the guy that he had been with the New York Jets. So I understand what you're saying about John Idzik handling Revis, but I think that he got fair return return, and I don't think that Revis was the same player that he was with Tampa or even New England after the Jets, and I think that the first and fourth round pick was certainly fair given the circumstance at the time, which is that Revis was coming off a major injury, and he was now heading into his late 20s, but no reason to relitigate this. I just wanted to throw that out there so that we're being fair as far as what was going on with John Idzik and the Jets at the time. But right now is a very different situation. Jamal Adams is a different personality and a different kind of player than Darrell Revis. Darrell Revis was somebody that was going to be made happy with nothing more than money. It seems like Jamal Adams is not in that camp. What's going on there? Can this be repaired? Because my sense is that maybe it can't.
That's probably the main storyline entering the offseason, you know, in addition to getting offensive linemen, which is essential, but not nearly as sexy a topic as whether Jamal Adams is going to be dealt. My position has been, and I think I'm going to stay with this position, is that, yes, Jamal Adams doesn't play a quote-unquote premium position, but if you're going to build your team the right way, you need to build around players and people like him. I'm not saying build around a safety. I think people don't quite understand when I say that you should build around people like Jamal Adams and players like Jamal Adams. I'm not saying to build around a safety. I'm saying you build around a core group of players. He should be among that core, as should Sam Darnold, as should Chris Herndon. And Chris Herndon's a tight end. So, you know, I'm not saying build around a tight end alone. But when you have that small cluster of players that you think you can win with and build a solid foundation with, to me, those three guys, we'll see about Quinnen Williams. You know, I think you invested so much in Quinnen Williams, such a high pick that, you know, at this stage, he should be a part of that core as well. So you're talking about a handful of players, not many players. That being said, the Jets, as I just said a moment ago, need offensive line help. So if Joe Douglas is going to trade Jamal Adams so he can position himself to get better offensive linemen, whether that's an offensive lineman on a different team or accumulate draft picks to get multiple offensive linemen, then I think he needs to explore that. That, is, to me, is not a shot at Jamal Adams. Now, Jamal is 24 years old. You know, he was drafted here. He became an instant leader just because of his natural leadership qualities. I can tell you that players in that locker room, specifically defense, they follow him. He doesn't really have to try. It's just kind of who he is as a person. And even when he was a rookie, second-year player, he's very good at talking to people on both sides of the ball in the locker room, you know, kind of getting a pulse of what's happening on the other side of the ball as well. You know, you said that he just played his worst game as a pro. I'm not saying that you're wrong. What I'm going to do is I'm going to plead ignorance on this one, because I don't know if this was the worst game. I know that he was aggressive on that one touchdown inside the five or inside the 10, in which there was a miscommunication with Darrell Roberts. I can't tell you if that was a Darrell Roberts issue, a Jamal Adams issue, or a combination of both. And I can't tell you if it was his worst game as a pro. I watched that game. I watched every snap. I've watched every snap that Jamal Adams has played. And I can't tell you coming out of that game that, you know what, my conclusion is it's the worst game he's ever played. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'll ask him this week, you know, just to get his, you know, his assessment on it. I don't believe, and I do think this is unfair, I don't believe that Jamal Adams checks out of football games mentally. I don't. Nothing about his DNA, his pedigree in college and the pros suggests that this is a guy who quits. He's not a quitter. He's the exact opposite of a quitter. And I know that, you know, him coming out and saying that he's not ready to talk to the general manager and the head coach rubbed, you know, a segment of the fan base the wrong way. And it's fair. You know, if you think that that is not how a player should act, you are entitled to that opinion. In many respects, I think that you're right. I don't want to be in a position where I'm apologizing for him, because, look, I've made my feelings about Jamal as a player and a person abundantly clear since he came into the league. I think he's a terrific player who's going to get better, and he's going to become one of the best safeties over the next 10 years. Now, I don't know if he's going to be the best. Maybe he is. I don't know. He's going to be a difference-making player, and he never gets in trouble off the field. So he's a great player who never gets in trouble off the field, who plays safety. So now people who are criticizing Jamal Adams are trying to marginalize him and his value by saying, well, he's a safety. Who needs a safety? How does it, you know, why would a guy like that think that he's Tom Brady? He's not Tom Brady. Now, he holds himself in a high regard. I think that players who are great players should hold themselves in a high regard. And I don't want to say that Jamal is delusional, because that's really an unfair word to use in this particular situation, but I do think that he has a high opinion of himself, just like I think that a lot of great players have high opinions of themselves. I don't think he's Tom Brady, obviously. I don't think he's Aaron Donald, but I do think that he's a dynamic, difference-making player that a team like the Jets, in their current situation, need to build around. Now, does he need to kind of understand the business a little bit more, develop a little bit more thick skin? Yes, I think that. I think that will come with time and experience. I thought Le'Veon Bell actually put it perfectly last week when he said, look, this is the only team this kid's been on. He came in here wanting to be, change the fortunes of this franchise. His feelings are hurt. And Jamal himself had said his feelings are hurt. And it's easy for somebody on social media to say, well, you know, why are his feelings hurt? His feelings shouldn't be hurt. Grow up, blah, blah, blah. Look, that's social media. I get it. And there is, however, some merit and validity to understanding that this is a cutthroat industry. It's not a family. Whenever a player, a coach, a general manager, and an owner describe their team as a family, I always roll my eyes because I know that's not reality. That's not fact. There's no loyalty outside of working hard and playing for your teammates in practice and in games. But the loyalty doesn't extend beyond that, because if a team is going to think that you can't help them anymore, or you can be used to gather assets to help them in a better way, or that you're too old, they're going to cut you. And if you, as a player, get a better offer in free agency, it doesn't matter that you like your coaches. It doesn't matter that you like your teammates. If you think that you can go to a place that's a better fit for you geographically, or maybe from a win-loss standpoint, or just from a money standpoint, you're going to leave. So it's not loyal. There's no loyalty. If this were a real family, I don't abandon my brother. I have an older brother. You know, I'll do anything for my brother. I'm not going to abandon him because something better comes along, and vice versa. That's what a family is. This is not a family. This is a cutthroat, multi-billion-dollar business. And I know that Jamal Adams understands that, but I also know that he had this vision when he got drafted by the Jets that he was going to lead them to where they haven't gone in a half a century. And that's an idyllic outlook, and I appreciate that. It's part of the reason why I like Jamal. But, just to get back to your original point, I do believe that if the Jets get an offer that they believe will make them better without him, they're going to take it. And I honestly think that, once the ill feeling, if he does get traded before the draft, once that, that initial annoyance or disappointment subsides, if he does end up going to the Cowboys or another team, I think he'll be a great player for whatever franchise he goes to. I think he's destined to have a great career, whether that means he's going to be a 10-year Jet or whether it means he's going to play for two teams or three teams, I don't know. But he's too good of a player. He comports himself in too good of a way. He never gets in trouble off the field. All of those elements to me are exactly what you want in a young player when you're building a foundation. So I'm not saying the Jets are going to give him away for 50 cents on the dollar. I'm also not going to say that Joe Douglas is going to shut the door on the possibility of trading him, because again, I think he would not be doing his job properly if he didn't explore all options. And the Jets don't have very many tradable assets right now. And Jamal Adams is a great enough player where he potentially could bring back a return that would help Joe Douglas and the Jets more than if Jamal Adams were on the team.
Just to clarify something, Manish, I didn't say that Jamal Adams had his worst game as a pro. I said that he had one of his worst games as a pro, which I'm fairly confident is the case. But I do want to break this down a little bit, because I understand what you're saying as far as he's 24 years old, he's a great player, and those are the types of players you want to build around. But here's the situation. Joe Douglas didn't go out seeking trade partners. people call him. In fact, when the Cowboys called, according to Adam Schefter, he first asked for Zach Martin and Tyron Smith and then moved on to a first and 2 second round picks. So he set a virtually impossible price. Same thing with the Baltimore Ravens. Apparently, the negotiations got a little closer with them. But really, what Joe Douglas was saying was, we've got this player who's a great player, but as you said, Manish, he's got so many needs that he needs to fill. He looks at somebody like Chris Ballard, and obviously Rex Hogan being the number two in command to Joe Douglas was there when Ballard made that deal for Darnold, and look at what he did with those picks. He was able to turn them into Braden Smith, who became a good starting right tackle, Quentin Nelson, who's an all-pro guard, and Darius Leonard, who's an all-pro inside linebacker. So in the course of one draft, he was able to take those assets and really start to turn things around in areas where the Colts desperately needed help. I think Douglas looked at it as, I don't necessarily want to trade Adams, but if somebody blows me away and gives me the kind of assets I need to rebuild this offensive line, to maybe get a pass rusher, to fix the cornerback situation, especially when you're considering the fact that, according to what I've heard, and a couple of other people have confirmed this, Jamal Adams' agent went to the Jets a couple of days before the trade deadline, didn't say necessarily that he wanted a trade, but did say that Adams would be okay with the trade. And then when you add to that the fact that the morning of the trade deadline, Adams' buddy Ryan Clark, who everybody knows is a media mouthpiece for Adams, is on the air talking about how much Jamal Adams wants to go to the Cowboys, Douglas is sitting there going, okay, well, his agent came and said he'd be okay with a trade. He's probably going to leave in 2 years. It's going to take me at least 2 years to build this thing up anyway. And by the time I do, he's going to leave as a free agent. I can get these assets. I'm not going to trade him unless somebody blows me away, but I'll be willing to listen. So I totally understand why Joe Douglas did what he did. He set an extremely high price for a really talented player, and nobody was willing to meet that price. Now, that might change in the offseason. Either somebody might make a better offer, or it could get to the point where the Jets and Jamal Adams just decide that divorce has to happen because of the circumstances that went down here. I do think that Adams is being disingenuous with how much he seems to be bothered by this, especially considering all the stuff that's leaked out. I do want to talk a little bit about Quinnen Williams, too, because that was another player that apparently the Jets were getting a lot of phone calls about, Manish. Kind of surprised about this, but in some ways I'm not, because if you're a general manager, why not shoot your shot? There was supposedly one team that kept calling and kept calling and kept calling and kept upping the offer and upping the offer. I can tell you it was not the Indianapolis Colts. From what I understand from George Bremer, who's my buddy who covers the Colts for CNHI Sports in Indianapolis, the Colts did call to ask about Quinnen Williams, but they were never going to be the team that was going to win a bidding war or anything like that, because Chris Ballard generally has a price and sticks to it. So the Colts did call to ask about Quinnen Williams, or at least that is what I've been told. However, they were not this mystery team that was bidding and bidding and bidding up the price for Quinnen Williams. What do you know about what happened with this Quinnen Williams story? Do you know who the team was? Do you know what the offer was? Or do you have any idea in the ballpark of what this offer was? And also, as far as Quinnen Williams goes, he had his first full sack in the game against the Dolphins, but then didn't play a lot after that. There's some buzz that there might be a wrist injury there. What do we know about that?
Well, this is what I'll say about, just as a general rule, not rule, but just to give people understanding what happens in the weeks leading up to the trade deadline. Every team, for the most part, calls every other team. You know, and the teams who stink, they get the most calls, because other teams want to pick at the carcass. You know, they want to try to get players who they believe the Jets might be willing to sell off, because, you know, they stink and they get a new general manager. He might have a new vision. What I think is not necessarily portrayed the right way is the idea of listening to calls. I got a good deal of respect for Joe Douglas. He was negotiating to trade Jamal Adams. It does not matter whether Stephen Jones picked up the phone and said, hey, who do you want for Jamal Adams? It was not a situation where Joe Douglas listened to Stephen Jones, listened to Eric DaCosta and others about what they were willing to offer for Jamal Adams. This was a negotiation, a back and forth. Well, no, we want this. We're not going to give you this, but how about this? And so the idea of like setting the bar ridiculously high, meaning that doesn't mean that Joe Douglas did not want to trade Jamal Adams. That means that that's what he came with, and he's looking what kind of counter. And if the counter to a one and two twos is a one and a backup player, then you're far off. And if the Cowboys aren't willing to get closer to the one and two twos, then obviously there's no deal. That's not to say that the only way that Joe Douglas would have traded Jamal Adams was if he got a one and two twos. That's not true. That's not accurate. If the Cowboys came back with, we'll give you a one, a two, and a three next year, or two threes, or a four and a three, or any number of combinations, who's to say that Joe Douglas would have said no?
We're assuming facts that are not in evidence. All we know is that Joe Douglas set a price. He asked for Zach Martin, who he had to know the Cowboys were not trading. He asked for Tyron Smith, who he had to know the Cowboys were not trading. And then he asked for an astronomical haul of draft picks. We don't know anything beyond that. So I get what you're saying, that he was willing to listen and then go back and forth. But the only thing that we know right now is that he set a huge asking price for Jamal Adams. What that says to me is that he didn't actually want to trade Jamal Adams. He was willing to consider it if one of these teams met his astronomical asking price. But to me, that's no different.
I disagree with that. But, I mean, I disagree with it. I know it because I disagree. I disagree with it because I do know that the Cowboys offered a player who's could probably help the Jets on the back end, but not necessarily a great player. So, I mean, we could be parsing words here, Scott, whether he wants to trade him, whether he's looking to trade him, whether he's open to trading him. The point is that you're entertaining, maybe that's probably the best word, you're entertaining the idea of trading this player, whereas you're not entertaining the idea of trading Sam Darnold, for example. I think we can all agree on that.
Wait a second, though. If somebody called up and offered Joe Douglas six first-round picks for Sam Darnold, you're telling me that he's not going to listen to that offer?
Right, but that's obviously unrealistic, and that's not even worthy of discussion. That's outrageous.
Right, but I'm just saying, so if somebody called and said to Joe Douglas, will you trade Sam Darnold? And if Joe Douglas said, give me four first-round picks, then you would say
that's
that he was
though.
Looking to get rid of Sam Darnold?
That's not realistic. What would be realistic is two first-round picks. That's a more realistic discussion.
Sure, but he asked for a first and 2 seconds for a safety. A quarterback, you would think he would have asked for maybe three or four first-rounders. Remember, Jay Cutler went for multiple first-rounders.
That is an initial asking price. That doesn't mean that that's the floor. That's the initial asking price. And the floor, i.e. the return or the counter, was so low, it's like when you buy a house. You know, mm-hmm. You could list a house for $1 million. And if I, as a buyer, say, you know what, my offer to you is $700,000. That's so far apart. Is there any haggle room? Can we meet in the middle? Is there any of that? There was no meeting in the middle. So my point is that if the Cowboys came closer to that one and two twos, not met the one and two twos, but came closer, then you can engage in further discussion. So my point is that, and again, I agree with what Joe Douglas did. I'm not saying that he should not have engaged in these discussions, but the narrative that he just picked up the phone and listened is not accurate. That's not how it transpired.
But I don't think that
he picked up the phone. That's not where the story ends. The story ends that he was willing to negotiate to trade this player, and it didn't happen. That's what happened.
Yeah, but I don't think that that's what people are claiming. I think what people are claiming is that Joe Douglas wasn't looking to trade Jamal Adams, and when he was called about him, he was willing to listen to astronomical offers for him, and if he got a really great offer that he loved, he would have been willing to deal him. I don't think anybody's sitting there thinking, well, he just answered the phone and that was it. I think that's really, again, we're kind of parsing words here. I understand what you're saying.
I mean, I don't know. I disagree with that. I see it every day on my social media feed.
Okay.
I get dozens of people every day saying, well, what's the problem? All he did was pick up the phone. All he did was listen. That's not all he did. And again, what he did was right. I wholeheartedly agree with what he did, but the notion that all he did was listen, I've heard it. Scott, I'm telling you, I've heard it. I see it. I read it every single day over the past five days or 6 days. Like, what's the problem? All he did was listen. All he did was listen to offers. Should he not listen? And I can't respond to everyone. I can't respond to 100 people.
Sure.
I got other things to do during the day. But I'm telling you, that's not all he did. Now, he wasn't, you know, he didn't have a sandwich board on the street saying, hey, I want to trade Jamal Adams. So come give me all your best offers. He wasn't making any kind of public advertisement. But once he got those calls and started engaging in conversations, he was willing to trade Jamal Adams.
Right, but that's where I think you and I are kind of at an impasse here, because I guess the best way to put it is we're kind of looking at this in a different way but coming to the same conclusion. In other words, we both think that Joe Douglas did nothing wrong. The difference is that you and I see it differently in terms of what constitutes quote-unquote just picking up the phone. I see that more as an expression. You see it more as a literal thing that fans believe. I understand what you're saying, and I'm sure there are fans that believe that, but I think that for the most part, it's more a situation where Douglas essentially said, I'm not looking to trade Jamal Adams necessarily, but if you blow me away, I'll consider it, which I'm fine with, and I get what you're saying, that it's not exactly the same as just picking up the phone. But either way, I think that we're going to see this carry on into the offseason, because I think that teams now know that there's blood in the water, and I'm sure that their Jets are going to get more phone calls, whether it's from Dallas again, the Ravens again, or a couple of other teams perhaps. I want to ask you something, though, about one of Adams' teammates in the secondary, and that's Darrell Roberts. This is the second time that the Jets have had to talk to him about unprofessional conduct off of the field. Now, there was an incident, and I'm not going to talk about it, but I was made aware of it. He was talked to previously. It didn't have anything to do with social media, but it was something else that was off the field. And now we have this situation where he posts what he posted on social media. And I went over this on the podcast the other day, so I'm not going to relitigate it. But essentially, he went at fans and told them that you either ride with the Jets or keep your mouth shut. That, to me, is not something that any player should be saying. I will say also that of all players to be saying it, Darrell Roberts certainly shouldn't be the one to say it at this point. But it sounds like the Jets clamped down on him finally and told him that this isn't going to cut it anymore. To me, that should have been the message after the first transgression, and we never should have gotten to this. And that might be another failure of management here and Adam Gase as the head coach in terms of disciplinary action. But I'm glad that they at least did something this time.
Yeah, you know, it's such a dicey situation because I can only imagine, and I know this from past players through the years, after a loss, there are some really vile, nasty things that anonymous fans say to players. It's so disgusting. Yes, Darrell Roberts did not play particularly well against the Dolphins. He had a really bad game, in fact. Maybe, you know, I'm trying to think of any other player who had a bad game to that level, but he might have the worst game from a player standpoint. So I don't know what was said to him. I don't know how nasty it got, how vile it got. My issue is that you can't criticize the fan base en masse. You know, you want to, you know, respond to, I wouldn't respond to any fan if I were a player because it, you know, it's such a emotional time after games. You know, fans are ticked off. Players are clearly angry and ticked off after a loss. So, you know, there should be a cooling off period in my mind, but if you are going to take that step and respond, obviously, you know, be professional. Don't threaten anyone's life like the guy in Cleveland who got cut. But go at that person and discuss something. If you want to, I wouldn't, but if you want to, discuss something with that particular person that you have an issue with. To, you know, cast this, you know, cast aspersions on the entire fan base is unfair because, by and large, most fans are reasonable, rational people. You know, they're not the people that go to Twitter and curse out players. You know, they're pissed. You know, they're probably cursing at themselves and maybe cursing at their TV, but they're not taking it to that next step where they're going at it directly at a particular player who didn't play well. And you're right. And maybe Scott, you're thinking of another example, or maybe we're thinking the same example. And I don't want to get into it either. But the other issue that he was spoken to was because of an incident that happened in the post-game locker room. You know, I don't want to get beyond that, but it was unprofessional behavior. Another player was involved as well. But hopefully, you know, this is the end of it, and he comports himself as a professional. I can just tell you, in my interactions with him, he's been fine. You know, I'm just giving you my personal experience. That's not to say that, you know, this goes for everyone who's ever interacted with him. I can just tell you, you know, from my experience, he's been fine. You know, I spoke to him last week, or actually a couple weeks ago, about something, you know, one-on-one, and, you know, I didn't have any issue with him. But clearly, like, this reflects poorly on the organization. You don't want your players doing this. And, you know, I thought that Adam Gase handled it well when I asked him about it on Monday. He said it was handled internally. I don't know if Adam specifically spoke to Darryl Roberts or there was somebody else in the organization. I would hope that Adam would have said something to him. But the bottom line is that the point got across to him that this can't happen. This can't happen again. And look, I don't want to belabor the Jamal Adams thing because you and I have discussed this now for a while. But I do want to say, I draw another analogy when it comes to the trade deadline with Le'Veon Bell. Mm-hmm. For one, they were shopping Robbie Anderson. That I don't think that's really up for debate. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Le'Veon Bell, what's interesting with what happened with Le'Veon Bell is if Le'Veon Bell, wanted to take a pay cut or that the euphemism is restructure his contract, I think he would have been moved. If I'm Le'Veon Bell and I sat an entire year because I didn't get what I thought I was worth from the Steelers, I'm never going to agree to any kind of pay cut, to be moved to a different team. But the finances on his deal and the money that he's owed next year made it so difficult for him to move. But the Jets did want to trade him. I don't think they were, having a billboard saying, hey, please call us on Le'Veon Bell. But they had enough discussions with a lot of people about potentially moving him. But the contract was the stumbling block, and he obviously did not want to take a pay cut. I understand that. Maybe if the frustration of losing was so much that he was willing to take less in future years with a different team, he would have done that. But I just think that knowing what I know about Le'Veon Bell and just knowing what everyone has seen, sitting out a year because of not really thinking he was getting what he was truly worth, the idea of him restructuring his contract right now or taking a pay cut for future years, that was never going to happen. But the Jets were willing to move on from him. I totally understand that. He's going to be 28 next year. He's a running back. And for as great as I think of a player he is, I know that Joe Douglas would not have signed him if he was a general manager for that price. And so if he could have gotten out of that contract, he would have. But he didn't. So I'd be interested to see if anybody wants him in the offseason. I just, again, don't think the contract is going to make that possible.
Play like a Jet. Play like a Jet.
Just circling back to Darryl Roberts for a quick second, I think if anybody said something especially personal to him, that's way over the line, that's a different story. And also, if he had addressed fans one by one, if he wanted to respond, like you said, I wouldn't have. But I think if fans are coming at him and just saying that he sucks or he's not worth the money or he's bad, if you're a professional athlete, you've got to just mute those people or ignore them or don't open your mentions, whatever it is. If that's going to bother you, then don't go on social media after a performance like the Jets had against the Miami Dolphins, and certainly don't go out there and make sweeping proclamations about Jets fans in which you tell them to either support you or not show up and root for some other team. That's essentially telling your customer base not to spend its hard-earned money on your product, which is a really bad business decision. But a really good business decision would be to take some of that hard-earned money and place wagers with it over at mybookie.ag using my brother Craig's picks. Because if you've been listening to the pregame shows on Sunday when Craig comes on to make his picks for the week, then you know he has been killing it every week on the podcast. So if you haven't been listening on Sundays when we do the pregame report and Craig gives his picks, you got to make sure you start listening to that and taking his picks and going over to mybookie.ag and placing them to make wagers and make yourself some money every weekend. If you go to mybookie.ag right now and use the promo code OVERTIME when you sign up, you'll get your first deposit doubled. That's right. They will match your first deposit when you sign up over at mybookie.ag using the promo code OVERTIME. You can bet on the Jets and the Giants this coming weekend, any of the other games around the league. Plus, you can do prop bets. Who's going to throw for more touchdowns, Sam Darnold or Daniel Jones? Who's going to have more rushing yards, Saquon Barkley or Le'Veon Bell? Despite the fact that it's a Jets home game, which team is going to have more fans at the stadium representing their team? I'd bet on the Giants on that one, sadly. You can bet on these prop bets and so much more over at mybookie.ag right now. Use the promo code OVERTIME and they will double your first deposit. Mybookie.ag, you play, you win, and you get paid. And if you're going to bet on the game, you should probably be there, especially since it's back home in New Jersey at MetLife Stadium. The Jets and the Giants aren't exactly having the best year, but it's still a fun rivalry, and that's why it's going to be a hot ticket. And if you don't have your tickets yet, you can get them at Vivid Seats. And I've got a great deal for you when you do go to buy your tickets. You can get up to $100 off on your very first purchase when you use the promo code OVERTIME at checkout. You can use that promo code to go to the Jets-Giants game on Sunday, or you can use it for a whole bunch of other events. You want to go to a basketball game, a hockey game, you want to go to a concert, a wrestling show, anything your heart desires, you can use that discount code to get yourself up to $100 off on your very first purchase. Just download the Vivid Seats mobile app and use the promo code OVERTIME at checkout. Now, Manish, I want to talk about Le'Veon Bell now because you brought him up and there was some news there. In the Daily News, you reported that Le'Veon Bell had an MRI. We don't know the extent of it. It may just be precautionary. But beyond Le'Veon Bell, what's going on right now with the injury situation? I mentioned it before, Quinnen Williams, there was some buzz that he may have a wrist injury. Also, do you know anything about the trade buzz with Quinnen Williams? Was there a team making a major offer? Do we know anything in the vicinity of what that deal might have been?
I don't know if a team was really putting on a full court press on Quinnen Williams. If they could get two ones, I would have traded him. But he's a young player that they believe in. I think, you know, I want to kind of be sure and say that I don't definitively know if they really believe in Quinnen Williams, because again, the guy who drafted Quinnen Williams is no longer a part of the organization. So, and Adam Gase, you know, changes his mind on players with the win. So, you know, I know that Adam Gase liked Quinnen Williams for a while. I mean, that again, that could change on a dime, just knowing his MO. The injuries, the first guy I want to talk about is Chris Herndon, because I do want to bring this back to what happened on Sunday. I don't quite understand Adam Gase's roster management. He had Chris Herndon active, and I know other guys are banged up. They got a lot of guys banged up, but he chose to take a gamble that Chris Herndon would feel good enough in warmups so he could contribute in the game. Now, he was active, but he did not play. So that to me is a roster miscalculation. It's mismanagement. You should have brought up somebody from your practice squad on Saturday and activated someone who could actually help you, whether it's offense, defense, special teams. Chris Herndon was essentially your eighth inactive guy. And that is really weird, considering the Jets were 1-6 entering the game and could use all the bodies, you know, that they could get to actually help them in the game. So to have an active player who admittedly was limited in practice, and you know, and Gase had said over and over that he had not kind of seen that burst that he wanted to see from Herndon all week, and then to make him active as opposed to bringing up somebody, you know, from the taxi squad who could, again, at the very least help you on special teams is very odd to me. That was really strange. And I'm going to run down through the rest of the injuries, but I do want to get to some clock management stuff that I know you're aware of as well, Scott, from Sunday. Mm-hmm. I know that obviously CJ Mosley's out, so he's not going to be around. Kelvin Beachum, I think there's a good deal of optimism he'll be able to practice in some form or fashion this week, probably initially on a limited basis. They could sure use him because Chuma Ndoga has had his fair share of struggles at left tackle. So, you know, he would be a plus if he could come back. Trumaine Johnson is nebulous to see if he's going to be back with his two ankle injuries. And we talked about Dal Roberts struggling. I think Nate Hairston had some issues against Miami as well. So I'm not saying that Trumaine Johnson could help because he hasn't really helped this year, but at least he'd be another body. But I know it just sounds early in the week, midweek here, that that Trumaine's availability for Sunday is going to be iffy, to say the least. Steve McClendon is dealing with a neck issue. We'll see if that's anything serious. Ryan Khalil has a chance to perhaps practice, but at this point, I think if Khalil were healthy, I'd believe Jonathan Harrison would still be the center. I don't know that definitively, but my sense is that the Ryan Khalil experiment is pretty much done. It didn't work out. They gave him $8 million. It's worth a flyer, I suppose. They had plenty of money under the cap. Why not take a chance on a former Pro Bowler? Unfortunately for them, it didn't work out. So, the idea of going back to Khalil, even if he's healthy, is something that I wouldn't do. We'll see if Adam Gase decides to go back to Khalil if he's not happy with Jonathan Harrison. But, I would tend to think that Harrison will be the starter here unless he's showing on tape that he's really ineffective. So, that's the major rundown. There's some other guys who are banged up, but those are the major players. But I did want to talk about the clock management because I know, Scott, you're smart enough to realize what happened toward the end of that game.
I don't think it takes a whole lot of brains to figure out that was a mess.
It's unbelievable. I mean, this is not a rookie coach. I mean, if it was a rookie coach in his eighth game, you could say, okay, you know, he's got to, you know, learn the ropes. This is Adam Gase's fourth year, and the Jets were down by two possessions, 11 points, when Miami started a drive with 6:23 left. They ran five plays and then punted. Adam Gase had all timeouts in his pocket. He didn't call any timeouts during that drive. So after they sacked Ryan Fitzpatrick on third down to force the punt, he could have called a timeout at about 3:40. Instead, he let the clock bleed an extra, basically, you know, 44, 45 seconds to under 3 minutes. And then he still had all his timeouts. The Jets get the ball down by two possessions with 2:50 to go. They have a 14-play drive. They only stop the clock once because of the two-minute warning. But they have a 14-play drive that results in a field goal. So before the Jets even started that drive, they had wasted 3.5 minutes by not calling any timeouts during the Miami drive. And then when the Jets get the ball, he bleeds about 2.5 minutes, an additional 2.5 minutes before Ficken kicks the field goal with 19 seconds left. He squandered 6 minutes of game time without using any timeouts, and then he called it to his first timeout on the next to last play of the game with 7 seconds to go after Fitzpatrick kneeled. I can't believe there wasn't anybody in the booth, anybody in the sideline that said, "Hey, Adam, we got to use our timeouts here. We're letting all of these seconds tick away." So I just can't. There's no explanation for it. When Gase was asked about it on Monday, he essentially said that, you know, it was a learning experience for him, which is, to me, it's either, hey, I checked out, or I froze, and or I had no awareness at all of how to use my timeouts and how I could put my team in a position to perhaps, you know, give them a chance to pull out a miracle. It's unbelievable that he wasted the last 6 minutes of that game by not calling timeouts. It's really the fact that they kicked that field goal with 19 seconds left. They could have easily kicked that field goal with over 2 minutes left, with 3 minutes left, you know, somewhere in that neighborhood. But instead, it was a death knell. By keeping those timeouts in his pocket, he effectively killed any chance of the Jets winning. And that, you know, that has nothing to do with, you know, how he's developing Sam Darnold or not developing Sam Darnold, that has nothing to do with his press conferences or revenge against the Dolphins. That's just poor clock management. That's fundamental coaching stuff. It's elementary. And that is just another reason why you have to scratch your head and say, you know, what's going on here? The central issue is him screwing up Sam Darnold to this point. The central issue, in my estimation, is him not understanding that he has a 22-year-old second-year quarterback and not Peyton Manning, who's been in an offense for 15 years, as his quarterback. So he needs to start calling plays and adapting plays to where his quarterback skill set is right now. I think Adam Gase has all these great ideas, but he has no idea how to streamline those ideas and implement those ideas to cater toward the quarterback that he has now, not the quarterback that he had 5 years ago who's headed to Canton. And too many times I think he's calling plays thinking that Peyton Manning is his quarterback and not a 22-year-old Sam Darnold. So that to me is the biggest issue, but I would be remiss if we didn't even, you know, discuss this clock management snafu.
Speaking of Peyton Manning, Manish, I think I figured something out. On January 4th, 2003, the Jets handed Peyton Manning the most embarrassing loss of his career, a 41-0 shutout beatdown at the Meadowlands. It was humiliating for Peyton Manning, and I think he waited all these years to get revenge on the team by recommending Adam Gase. I think that was the long play that Peyton Manning was going for. Took him a long time, but he finally got his revenge on the Jets organization for showing him up in the playoffs and embarrassing him with that 41-0 loss. Speaking of embarrassing, though, Manish, last order of business, the Jets and the Giants coming up on Sunday. I think if you would have asked most Jets fans a couple of weeks ago, what is your nightmare scenario? They would have said Daniel Jones outplays Sam Darnold. Most of the crowd is Giants fans. No. And on top of that, the Jets get beaten down really badly. Those three things, how likely do you think that all three of them are to occur?
That would be, I said earlier that I thought that the Dolphin loss was rock bottom, but if for whatever reason Daniel Jones lights up the Jets and Sam Darnold struggles, maybe the Jets would have found a new rock bottom. But I will say this, I am no longer picking the Jets for the remainder of the season. I don't care if I'm wrong, and I probably will be wrong at least a few times, because I don't think that the Redskins and the the Bengals are any good. I don't think the Giants are any good, but then again, the Jets aren't any good. So, yeah, that would be embarrassing. I feel like embarrassing is a word that everyone other than Adam Gase the other day, you know, that's like the recurring theme of this season. It's embarrassing. Adam Gase was not embarrassed publicly, at least, losing to Miami. He said that you can't get embarrassed, but then like 2 weeks earlier, he said losing to the Patriots was embarrassing. So this guy's all over the map. It's a terrible game, right? 3-14 combined. I think the Giants have lost, what, 5 or 6 in a row?
Mm-hmm.
So they've got the longer losing streak. The Jets fans can hold their, you know, they can hold on to that, I guess. But, yeah, it would be bad. I don't know if losing to the Giants on Sunday would be worse than losing to the Dolphins. I honestly think that for this year, you know, losing to Miami was probably going to be the low point. But, yeah, I think, you know, Daniel Jones playing well and Sam Darnold not would really make things that much more annoying for Jet fans. You know, I'm going to continue to believe that Sam Darnold is going to be a good player. I don't know how it's going to shake out this year. You know, I said this the other day, contrary to what some people might think, I really do wish that Adam Gase were a better coach, because I think that Sam Darnold can be a special player with good coaching. He really hasn't had good coaching for a long time, dating back to SC, and he's kind of overcome that as best as he could. But the talent and the tools, this physical skill set, you know, the mental makeup, that's all there. And I just think if he had good coaching, you know, he could do so many good things in this league. And I'm not giving up on a guy like that. He's 22 years old. He's only played, what, 17, 18 games as a pro. So whether that means that Adam Gase can be that coach for him, or another guy comes in to be that for him, I don't like seeing great talent being wasted because of poor coaching, whether it's Sam Darnold or anybody else. And I see great talent there, and I hope, I hope that for his sake, for the franchise's sake, that he gets the proper coaching so he can do all the things that, you know, I fully believe he can do.
One thing to keep your eye on in this game, Manish, and I don't know that we've ever seen this in NFL history, but because of the nature of things where there are going to be a lot of Giants fans in attendance, so it'll be a mixed crowd, you could potentially, depending on how this game goes, hear dueling chants for the firing of both head coaches of the two teams. I don't know if we've ever seen that before, but it's something to look forward to, if for no other reason than it would be really great comedy in a season where there's been a lot more crying than joy, unfortunately, for both Jets and Giants fans. Manish, thanks so much for coming on. Always appreciate it. A great discussion, as we have every week here on Midweek with Manish. I know that you've got that Christopher Johnson piece up, so if anybody hasn't read that yet, go ahead and read it right now. Well worth your time. What else do you have cooking over at the Daily News?
Well, it's Giant Jet Week, so there's always something that'll pop up out of nowhere. You know, I don't think Shermer or Gase want to lose to the other, so it'll be some interesting storylines. We didn't even discuss Saquon Barkley. He's probably the best player that on the field. He'll be the best player on the field on Sunday, so it'll be interesting to get the Jets fans' thoughts on him. Leonard Williams, obviously, playing against his former team. I'm sure there'll be some revenge factor there as well, but it's unfortunate that both of these teams aren't very good, because it's so much more exciting when, you know, they're both playing for something, if they're both in the playoff race. And, you know, that obviously hasn't been the case. So I'd be interested to see if Jet fans sell their tickets, and if it becomes a partisan Giant crowd, or if Jet fans are actually going to trek out to see a 1-7 team play a 2-7 team. You know, you'd mentioned a dueling firing chance, and I don't know if this is going to happen. I know that Joe Beningo said last week, I believe, on WFAN that he had heard that there's a possibility of a plane flying overhead, you know, asking or demanding Adam Gase's ouster. You know, we'll see. You know, I will react to all that stuff. I don't advocate for that. I can't promote any of that kind of stuff. But I think that, you know, once it gets to that point, I've been around this team long enough, this organization, these fans long enough that, you know, when fans rally to a cause like that, it's, you know, it's just an overwhelming atmosphere, and it's a toxic atmosphere. It's not something I know that Jet fans particularly enjoy, but there seems to be this tidal wave crashing down on the head coach right now.
Dueling firing chants, a plane flying overhead demanding the firing of the head coach. Boy, this is certainly something that's fun this time of the year. We're already talking about draft prospects. I wish the Jets could just get this on track, and hopefully at least Sam Darnold can start to play better against the New York Giants and outplay Daniel Jones, but we will have to wait and see. In the meantime, make sure you're reading Manish in the Daily News. Follow him on Twitter. And for the latest and greatest in New York Jets podcasts, you know where to go. That's Turn on the Jets Digital and turnonthejets.com.